Welcome to Pod Space Nine, the last stop for trash in the Alpha Quadrant. This is a rewatch podcast for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, featuring this week three veteran viewers and one newbie. My name is Justin, and I'll be your way team commander. Joining me is my science officer, Anna, Irish suffering specialist, Evan, and our acting ensign, Jude. Jude, Anna, Evan, how you doing?
All right.
Yeah.
I like that I'm qualified as veteran in this. In that I've seen some episodes in syndication when I was a child.
I mean, for the purposes of our podcast, we have it's a pretty low bar. Yeah.
Fair enough.
It's a day in the week, and I definitely remembered we were recording today before 3 p.m. That's a thing that I definitely did, and that's definitely not why Anna has both summaries today.
And I, in addition to doing both summaries, I tallied up my hours worked for this week and came in at a smooth 62.
Ouch.
And you might be asking, Justin, why didn't you? It's because I was sick this week. That's how I was.
I fell down the stairs trying to take a cute picture of my dog. If we're just like sharing stupid things that, you know, we've done.
I love that we're qualifying me working that number of hours as stupid, because that is correct. That is a correct assessment.
I feel like falling down the stairs trying to take a picture of a dog is exactly the kind of bad pod energy we want to bring. So yeah, I appreciate that.
Evan, also welcome back to the show.
Hey, yeah, I'm back, and I even have my right microphone plugged in this time, so you and all your listeners can enjoy my velvety
voice. Thank you. Deathrus will be pleased.
I don't know how I feel about that.
It's all for him. It's all for you. Listen, we gotta. He's gonna suffer so much otherwise. Just listening to us bullshit. So. Might as well give him
For next time, I've gotta put together one of the Simpsons, like, you know, do it for her meme, except all with pictures of Aaron and Zathras.
All right. So this week we have our penultimate episode of season two. We are covering episodes 24 and 25 of season two, The Collaborator and Tribunal. Anna, if you want one of us to do the reading of the stuff you wrote, feel free, but take us away.
All right. I'm happy to do the reading on these, although I may get a glass of water partway, you know, after one of them. So this is episode 24 of season 2, The Collaborator, story by Gary Holland, teleplay by Gary Holland, Ira Stephen Bear, and Robert Hewitt Wolf, and directed by Cliff Bowl. So we start out with Jude's 100% absolute favorite thing, orb experience.
It's not an orb. Beryl, it's a chalice.
Beryl has a very sinister orb experience where chalice. He wanders a
chalice
deserted,
experience.
He wanders a deserted Deep Space Nine, first encountering the hanged body of a monk, and then Kira, who wants to like play spring ball.
Mm.
I do like her little sporty outfit in this.
It's a good little outfit.
It
works.
I felt the lingering specter of the squirt bottle while I was watching it, and I just figured I wouldn't comment too gratuitously on it.
So they cut down the hanged monk, who Beryl identifies as Prilar Beck. Except it's not Prilar Beck, because whoops, it's Beryl. So after that intro, we rejoin Beryl in Kira's quarters, where they are both in a haze of postcoital bliss. Kira laments that he can't stay longer since the election for Kai is in a few days, and Beryl is the presumed favorite for the job as Apaka's mentee. Beryl is concerned that he won't be able to replace Apaka, who held Bajor together during the occupation. The two head to the promenade, where they encounter everybody's favorite space Karen, Vedic Wynn, who is currently indoctrinating a group of children.
Oh.
My child, God hates you and will only love you if you do exactly what I say.
Oh, I love her and I hate her so much.
My notes in this section are just no.
Quick note for anyone not familiar, this is the same actress who played Nurse Ratched in One
Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Louise Fletcher was an amazing actress and just plays the hell out of this role.
Yeah. This is a role easily, we're probably supposed to talk about this in the discussion section, but I don't care. This is a role that easily could have been just annoying, but it's not. It's repulsive in the best way. Because you can't get to repulsive if it's not well done. Otherwise it would just be irritating, but it's not irritating. It's repulsive. And as much as I hate it, I can't but credit the actress for such a well done job.
I hate the character so much, but I love every second she's on camera. But anyway, so Braille and Wynn verbally spar over interpretations of faith. And Wynn reminds Braille that the election is still 2 days away and there may yet be an October surprise. The verbal sniping between the three is interrupted by a different surprise. An elderly Bajoran man is recognized as a Cardassian collaborator named Kubus Oak. Odo arrives, confirms the identification, and places the man under arrest.
I want to note that Oak looks like fucking Donald Trump.
We'll get into his accent later, but...
Yeah. So, Braille returns to the orb, of course, where he...
It's not
has
an
a vision.
Orb. It's not an orb. It's a chalice. And if you don't want me to interrupt you, every time you say it, you have to call it a chalice.
Barail returns to his mystical experience device. Where he appears as Kai.
The sippy cup of sight.
He appears as Kai and is surrounded by a group of Vedics. Opaka also appears and tells him that it is his destiny to walk in her path. And the two of them approach Prilar Beck, who has a gift from the prophets. A venomous snake that, when Braille picks it up, becomes a noose in his hands. That's not ominous at all.
Oh, we're just jumping over the Gamja Bar bit.
So insecurity. Kubus defends his collaboration as necessary to keep the situation on Bajor from getting worse, and says that he nearly wants to return home for his final years.
Final retirement package for this motherfucker.
Right. Odo and Kira remind him that his participation was a lot more gung-ho than he's painting it, and that he's permanently exiled from Bajor for a good reason. And meanwhile, Wynn visits Sisko in his office, claiming to want to bury the hatchet and appear together publicly in support of Bajor joining the Federation. Sisko, not having been born yesterday, tells her that sounds fantastic. After the election, because the prime directive, bitch. As Wynn's ship prepares to leave the station, Odo informs Kira that Kubus is on board, having been given sanctuary by Wynn.
That bitch.
They do some digging, and it appears that Kubus may have provided information regarding the Kendra Valley Massacre, where 42 resistance members, including Opaka's son, were killed by Cardassians after Beck revealed their location. Beck later hanged himself and confessed his involvement in his suicide note. After Wynn's departure, she confirms that Kubus has offered to reveal the identity of the person who ordered Beck to betray the resistance. Vedic Barile. After Kira objects to this baseless accusation, Wynn goads her into taking on the official investigation into the matter. Kubus claims that Braille met with Beck on the station the day after the massacre, and that Braille's refusal to let Beck confess the betrayal led to his suicide. Braille admits to Kira that he was on the station that day and that he met with Beck, but the topic of their discussion is, under the sanctity of the confessional. Kira and Odo find that the communication logs between Beck and the Vedic Assembly have been sealed and enlist Quark into helping them hack the seals, only to find that the message logs themselves have been erased. O'Brien isn't able to restore the files, but is able to identify who deleted them. Braille. We once again join Braille in the orb. Mystical vision device.
Thank you.
Where Beck accuses him of letting him die, Braille embraces a vision of Kira, who then transforms into Wynn.
I think you forgot to include that he kisses a vision of Kira that turns into
a
wind.
Naked wind.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely horrifying.
Don't worry, it won't be the last time on the show.
Yes. not the last time we see Naked Wind.
I was just gonna leave it hanging on the air what the last time that was, but thank you.
this vision of Kira also presents him with a gift from the prophets. This time it's a dagger with which she stabs him in the gut. Kira confronts him in the real world about what she's found, and Braille justifies it by claiming that the Cardassians would have killed all 1,200 Bajorans in the valley if they had not found the resistance cell. When Kira calls Wynn, she is informed that Braille has already withdrawn from the election. But something still doesn't sit right with Kira, who digs back into the archives. After Wynn is elevated to Kai, Kira approaches Braille. He did not fully cover his tracks and inadvertently neglected to delete his own alibi. It was Apaka herself who betrayed the resistance cell, since she knew the location from her own son. He sacrificed his own career to preserve her memory, and Bajor is now saddled with Wynn as its spiritual leader. The episode ends as the two of them embrace and then go pay their respects to the new Kai.
So my funny thing in looking into like the back date of this episode was that originally when they wrote this episode, they were planning on having Beryl become Kai.
Yeah.
Which they're like 2/3 of the way to this episode, and somebody's just like, wait, what the fuck? That's just wrong. That is the wrong storytelling choice.
Right. You need to like, you know, because you know, otherwise he's just gonna be like, yeah, the new Kai, like on board with the Federation, you know, sleeping with the second command on the station, all good. We've got friends in power.
And they're like, wait, no, we can keep bringing... Louise Fletcher likes this job and wants to keep coming back. What are we doing?
I cannot express how deep my sigh of disappointment and sadness was when she walks out in the Kai's costume. Even though I knew she would. I want to be clear. I thought her first name was Kai when we started this show. Because that was who I knew the character as. I just knew Kai Wynn was a character that I vaguely remembered hating from random episodes. I thought Kai was her name. When we first met Kai Opaka, I was like, why don't I hate this character? I remembered hating a character named Kai.
That's so funny.
If it makes you feel any better, I definitely have that this episode as well, because I forgot about the titles. So when I was first doing my notes, I was like, okay, so Vedic does this, and then wait a second, they're both Vedic. Wait.
Yeah.
They're both Vedic. They're both, it's Wynn and Beryl. Yep. All right. Notes,
so,
notes
so sad. I mean, obviously, yes. Obviously, Beryl is fucked the second Kira says she's in love with him. But there was no way, like from a storytelling perspective, that he should have won.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Wynn is a much more interesting character to have as the Vedic or as the Kai.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But God, I hate it. I said, I can't remember if we were recording when I said it. I don't think so. I hate these two episodes with all fondness. I enjoyed them.
Yeah.
And I'll enjoy talking about them, but for wildly different reasons, I hated both of these episodes. I hate Kai so much. Again, Kai Wynn. I hate Wynn so much that this episode was just like morally repugnant to me.
I like
and
that.
I had similar reasons.
I'm fairly certain that Louise Fletcher would hear you say that and be like, yes, got it.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that everyone involved in the making of this episode would take what I just said as a victory and a ringing endorsement, because that feels very much like what they were aiming for. You're supposed to want to just strangle her and throw her off the back of a cruise ship.
Yeah.
But God, it just makes me so not even angry, just like.
You just go,
I love her and Kira like sparring so much though, like that, you know, where she's got the like my child intensifies. And Kira's just like, bitch, I wasn't calling security to protect you. I was calling to security to protect from you.
Yeah, I love that, like, her and Barile are, like, verbally fencing. Mm-hmm. And then Kira comes in, like, if you want to extend this metaphor, they're, like, fencing, and then Kira comes in like a cannonball and just blows up the entire duel. Like, no subtlety whatsoever.
Kira refused to have subtext.
No subtlety whatsoever.
And that is absolutely acceptable. Particularly, because, like, here's the thing. For a political episode, no one here is actually good at politicking.
Except for Cisco.
Yeah.
Cisco's season.
Cisco is just like, I'm not going to juggle a hand grenade.
Cisco's, I'm not touching this. But like, everything is just so straightforward for
politics. Such a great observation. Fucking Barile is a doof.
Yes.
Kira is an absolute bulldozer. She's a spandex clad bull in a china shop, and Wynn
is acting like she's playing fourth dimensional chess.
She's checkers.
Like playing fucking Makala. Even checkers. That has
changed.
She's just like, I have the ace of spades, and I'm taking this trick, and I'm going to do it like this is Succession.
Yeah.
like when she goes to Cisco and she's like, oh yeah, maybe we could be seen in public together. The council would surely agree to that post haste. It's like, what did you think you were going to, like, that wasn't sneaky. Yeah, that wasn't.
I love that Cisco's response to this is like, how dumb do you fucking think I am?
I like to headcanon that, like, the popular, like, the pop culture image of, like, Starfleet officers, of everybody who's not in the Federation, is just God's perfect Iowan corn-fed himbo.
Now I have another another theory here, which is that if we look at Barile and then consider maybe everyone else in, like, the high echelons of Bajoran, you know, faith is just so stupidly straightforward that even the tiniest bit of subterfuge can't be seen through.
You know, I would like to think that that Barile would see through, like, such an obvious ploy, but I'm not sure that he would. Like, I'm not sure that he wouldn't just be like, you know what? Maybe we can put our differences behind us and appear together in public. Maybe we could.
Hold on. Let's think this through.
The prophets want me to give you a
chance.
They
have just spent, how long were they under the heel of the Cardassians?
60, 70 years. Nobody knows how to be a dirtbag politician.
Not just that, two or three generations, right? Two or three entire generations where their oppressors were professional, shitty, snaky liars and political deceivers.
I hate to say it, but I think we do have one Bajoran in this episode who was probably pretty good at politics in his day, and that was probably Kubis.
Okay, I just want to talk about this. Kubis is a space masshole. Just the accent.
Yeah, no, we'll get to Kubis. Hold on, I want to finish my thought here. The Bajorans have literally spent three generations assigning the qualities of political, like, skill and subtlety to Cardassians. So it actually kind of makes sense that anyone with it, and then not having any political skill, because anyone that did have political skill ends up a collaborator and exiled. So what do they end up with at the end of this? They end up with a bunch of people whose version of political expertise is like Kira Nerys shooting people. So I actually kind of am on board with this. And then you have people like Kubus, who seems shocked to find himself exiled for his crimes.
I like Kubus was like, come on, I'm an old white man. Let's rehabilitate my image. Come on, I'm just a little bit of a war criminal.
If I hadn't sentenced all those people to death, then like somebody else would have.
Listen, my name was on the forms, but did you see how fun my signature was? It had a bunch of loops.
Gosh, he is the worst, and it's made, and the actor just makes it worse. Especially with, I mean, he's just got that New England accent. And I'm just like, I'm sorry, I can't.
Like,
what?
It's like, are you here from, like, you know, are you here from Martha's Vineyard?
I want to believe that there is a possible worse place than Boston in the galaxy. Space Boston.
Yeah, it's the Bajoran Boston. Bajostin. Bajastin.
Okay. Nomination for episode title, Bajastin.
Oh, Christ. What a fucking episode.
Yeah.
What else do you say? I love that, like, I got to the end of this episode and I was like, oh, so he played the trolley game and lost. And it's like, oh no. It's even worse.
Yeah.
Opaka played the trolley game, and this poor bastard just is going to take a fall for it so that nobody ever knows. It's even sadder than that.
And actually, this time watching through, like, something struck me that I'd never, like, cottoned on to before, which is that, so the orb prophecy that, that Barayal...
Chalice prophecy, or mystical vision device... prophecy.
The prophecy from the prophets, where Barayal will walk in Opaka's footsteps. But that is in fact accurate. It just doesn't refer to her being Kai.
Yeah.
It doesn't refer to being Kai. It refers to, like, making a terrible, terrible sacrifice for what one considers the greater good.
Well, or it refers to him taking the blame for Opaka's actions. Oh, yeah, no, that was totally, when there was one set of footsteps, that was totally me. That was not Opaka. Opaka was over there being the most wonderful person you could possibly
imagine. What I
want
to know is, what does the rest of it mean? Because I've sat and thought about it. Not a long time. I had a day. But what the fuck? What's the snake about? Why does he have a vision where he's boinking Kai Wynn?
I mean, I think the snake is fairly obvious, that it's like that the gift from the prophets is something venomous, you know, like.
What's the gift from the prophets then?
Opaka's sins. And then it turns into a noose to hang himself with.
Mm. Why is that a gift from the prophets, though?
Hey, it's a gift. Doesn't mean you have to like the gift.
Because the prophets fucking hate Barayal. This is the answer. Because, like, you know, we might talk about this some more later, but, like, the writers hate Barayal as much as they hate O'Brien.
Okay, here's the thing. That's good to know. But these fucking chalices are ostensibly, like, giving visions from actual, like, nth dimensional beings?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah.
So what the fuck are they doing? Are they just, like, stirring his brain a little bit to see what happens? Like,
they didn't. Okay, so, like, let's take the step back to, like, the what we'll say the atheist perspective, even not even really, but if you were considering that the prophets have a thing for anything, the prophets, there is no, like, truly mystical element besides him seeing what's coming, and what's coming, the bed was already made because Opaka did the thing, right? What ultimately comes down to is his choice in what to do with that information, because he's the one who is going to have to make that choice, because everyone knows what Wynn was going to do. So now it's up to Barayal. Here is your poison pill, and your choice is either to carry the memory of Opaka or tarry, like,
yeah, I
fall
see.
On
I
your
guess.
Sword.
I let me put it this way. I think that as prophecies from the prophets, they were a little hogwashy. Also,
I mean, that's religion, my friend.
Also, a question I had is it healthy to be using alien brain devices that frequently?
So
it's like 3 times in 3 days.
I can
Does
imagine,
that not come with a warning?
I can imagine that somebody who was, you know, about to become the spiritual leader of a planet, you know, maybe was a little nervous about that and was consistently seeking the, you know, spiritual aid. And I think one of the things that is interesting is that I do not think that the prophets and their visions correspond with what we traditionally, maybe from like fantasy literature, associate with prophecy.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of the time, the prophet's visions are less, we are going to give you a fun poem that is going to explain the plot to you. Mm-hmm. I just watched Percy Jackson recently, and you know, I love that series because I love that series is like, I read them when I was much older than I would have, but I enjoyed them because I was working night shifts at a bookstore and frankly had way too much time on my hands. And I like prophecies and I like how you can twist those. The prophets are more like, we're going to give you some interesting dreams. You're just going to be lucid for them and don't worry about it.
It's basically like, okay, well, we don't have a concept of like linear time, and like we saw a bunch of stuff that relates to you and we're going to like give it to you, but you get to filter it through your own subconscious and like have fun with that.
So basically the prophets is like doing shrooms.
Yeah.
I was about to say the prophets are like, hey man, have you ever tried ayahuasca?
Okay. All right.
Except noted. You don't have any like good feelings or like anything. It's just you sort of just like feel like afterwards of like, got a lot to think about it. Why was my political rival naked?
I would be very concerned about anybody using those devices too frequently. I would have to imagine there are side effects that have not been well documented.
Put a pin in that thought.
Besides losing elections. there's no way.
All I'm saying is we never see Wing insult the chalice.
I believe she.
Well, I was just gonna say I don't want any answers, but I will be interested to see how often Kai Wynn sticks her head in the chalice bucket, because I bet you it's either all the time or never, but nowhere in between.
Yeah, I don't. Either we get this answer super early or super late in the series, and I can't remember which it is. So I don't want to accidentally spoil anything.
Well, we'll find out.
I think we've already had it because I think it's in one of her like early conversations with Sisko, where she says that like this, she's never spoken like this. The prophets have never spoken to her.
Headphones. I think she says in the first episode she appears in that she sees a vision, and I think it's established like later in like season 7 when she's talking to Bajoran Dukat that she reveals that she's never had the prophets talk to her.
That's possible. That's possible.
I think that's what it is because I think she gives an answer of like, oh yeah, no, I saw this in a vision that I had to come to the station.
Yeah,
but it's in reality it's either a conflict between what we're told later or it's her lying.
Yeah. At some point she says something to Sisko about being jealous of him, that he's spoken to the prophets and she hasn't.
Yeah. That's later in the series.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I think we can bring Jude back. And Jude, I love that you have already figured out the theme of Kira's love life.
She loves him. He's fucked.
Yeah.
Yep.
Kira's paramours.
That's Star Trek, baby.
You know, if the genders are reversed, I would call it like one of the worst cases of like shit happens that I'd be like, damn, this is like women in refrigerator levels, but it's sort of kind of funny when it's happening to dudes.
I mean, also, I would say that it's not like used as motivation. Yeah. It's just,
they have a real bad time.
It's just used as torment.
It's the fucking, to go to anime, it's the Yoko kiss from Gurren Lagann. Fucked.
I will say, though, is it just me? Or is there nothing particularly sexy about Kira and Beryl in that first scene? Like,
I was going to say that was some of like the least hot makeout film. Like, have I
gone too far around the bend at this point? That like boring hetero makeout scenes no longer do it for me, or
like the O'Briens and the runabout in the next episode like feels more genuine to me.
Yeah. Well, I have thoughts about that scene too, but yeah, that scene had better like zhuzh than this one did. That one. I have
fandom's answer for you, Jude, which is that Kira is in fact a lesbian.
Well, yes. What did I say about that one? Hold on. I gotta look at my notes.
I
called this a fuck monk episode, by the way.
Yes.
Fuck monk.
Several times. I find neither politics nor Kira and Beryl particularly sexy, nor do I find the intersection any better. And I stand by that. I don't think two people in bed talking politics is sexy, and I don't think Kira and Beryl are sexy together. And I don't think Kira and Beryl talking Bajoran politics in bed is sexy.
I think it's a little funny to propose trading votes for oral sex, but that's just me.
I think in the year of our Lord 2024, I don't find anything remotely arousing about politics.
I can find politics sexy if it's arousing. Evil people talking about politics.
Well, yes. Okay, we're not talking. That's not politics. That's villainy.
That's
villainy, and that's different.
But yeah,
villainy. Yes, sure, 100%.
Listen, they just they don't have chemistry. Just the way that it is. I mean, part of that is because Beryl is a fucking piece of cardboard,
and Kira has terrible taste in that.
I mean, Kira's taste in men is the Lisa Simpson's magazine of non-threatening boys.
Yes.
That's not encouraging. I am legitimately terrified of what they're going to do with Kira's love life in this show. You have said nothing encouraging about where it's going.
So speaking of terrifying things with Kira's love life, Jude, how did you feel about Odo's little like blip there when Kira says I love him and he's just like no, I'm having an emotion.
Not he's good like, now.
Really? Huh?
I didn't think anything about it at the time, but now I really don't feel good about it. Odo's supposed to bang a Ferengi, not get a thing for Kira. Oh, no. I don't like that.
I mean, I'm thinking this bit, like, that's Odo. Like,
Odo,
I think Odo shipped them a little bit. Odo's finally, you fucking realize that you love
I hope that's what you're inferring. If you're inferring that Odo likes Kira, I am going to be an unhappy camper.
Well, is that little flinch that he has, which apparently it seems like that was Renee...
Renee doing a thing, and I think like the intention of the scene is like, oh, finally you got to it.
Yeah.
Mm, okay. I want that to be true. So if it's not, lie to me. Let me have ignorance a little longer, because I cannot think. Nope, I can't think of I don't want Odo paired up with anyone besides Quark, but I can't think of a pairing I like less.
Interesting.
Quark and Sisko, maybe.
I don't know.
No, that'd be fun. That's so weird. No, that'd be fun.
We shall see where the show goes.
Gonna,
I suppose
we're gonna get some Quark. We're gonna get some Quark and Sisko the next episode. So, like in the season finale, that is.
Yeah.
Okay, I was about to say I did not see one hide nor hair.
No, we'll get to that.
There's a great Quark scene in this one, though, where we're like, they've got him hacking for them, and like Odo tries to like goosplain about how to hack into the archives, and Quark is like, sure, if I were a fucking amateur.
Yeah, I love the two, Kira and Odo are like trying they want to ask for a favor, but they don't know how to just ask for a favor. So they decide to go for like law enforcement intimidation instead. And Quark is finally like, ah, fuck it. Like, just bows to the inevitable. Everything about Quark in that scene is good. God, Quark is like rapidly becoming my favorite character on this show.
Join the club.
Good pick. Quark is absolutely justified in everything in that scene. Like, Kira and Odo are fucking trying to strong arm and be like, whoa, we need you to hack into these records. And he's like, that's illegal, and you're a cop. And they're like, well, fucking do it anyways, you little shit. And he's like, I want it in writing that you're not going to convict me over this. And they're like, no. It's like, no, listen, Quark knows what he's doing. Like,
man, yeah.
I also love that no deed goes unpunished. No good deed ever goes unpunished is a rule of acquisition.
285, God. Which I think is the highest number one there is.
Oh, Evan, you have to tell these folks what your partner has.
Oh God. Yeah. Well, yeah. We in living in my car, because you got to have it for the road, is a copy of the Ferengi rules of acquisition.
That is the place. Well, just I mean, if you can't have a lawyer on call, the second best thing to have is the rules of acquisition.
Oh, I think we'll see what the second best thing to a lawyer a is next episode.
All right. Hardly know her. I'm pulling the plug on this one. Last thoughts on?
I have to call out my absolute favorite thing in this episode, which is when Wynn is talking to Sisko, and Wynn's like, I would hardly want the people to think us as, and Sisko goes,
oh, God,
enemies.
Avery Brooks so can good. Make any word sound so freighted with meaning.
He just has the best ability to like load any word with just like, yeah, import significance.
Yeah,
and like this is like half the reason why I'm never like actually mad narrative wise that Wynn won the election, because like Avery Brooks and Louise Fletcher playing off against each other is just like chef kiss.
Run it back to the heat death of the universe. I love him. Yeah. Uh huh.
No, 100%.
All right, let's go to the next one.
I have one more tiny thing, and absolutely, fucking council vote on whether or not you want to do this or not. But as the resident anti-Zionist Jew, kind of wild to go into this and being like, yeah, man, there's this giant massacre. 42 people were killed.
When I was talking with, we had a fanfic author on, John Konka, who does a Star Trek fan fiction progress project. And one of the things he talked about is like one of the most like frustrating things with the huge scale of Star Trek and stuff is that whenever you put a number on something, it feels, you know, it makes everything.
Yeah.
Like it instantly either is too big or too small, or just you get all this associated baggage with it. And it is, it's not frustrating. Yeah. It's just like, it's one of those things of 43 people is a massacre. I mean, like, granted,
one of them was the son of the space pope. So like, you know, there is that, which I do have a note from Memory Alpha, which is that, Camille Sabiola, who plays Opaka, was thrilled by her character having a son, because not only can their monks fuck, but she loved that she was a working mom.
That's great. Love that.
She's like, I'm not just space pope. I am like working mom space pope.
That's pretty good.
And she also felt that Opaka was 100% justified.
Noted.
I'm just saying, if Star Trek is on track, like for Star Trek being so on track with possible Irish reunification this year. To get the scale of things wrong, it just felt a little weird.
Bell riots 2024.
Oof.
It's a bumper sticker I have on my car.
Okay.
I think we can probably move on to the next one, though.
Let's take it away.
Yep.
Yeah, so episode 25, Tribunal, written by Bill Dial and directed by Avery fucking Brooks.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the first one he is directing, right?
He will. That's cool. Think he'll direct a number of them. Like the it's like more than like half a dozen, I think.
Yeah,
that's dope.
Nine. He will direct 9 episodes. So that's
dang.
Continuing the tradition of great Star Trek actors who become Star Trek directors.
Yeah.
So we join Miles in his anxiety-filled last hours before he leaves the station for a week-long romantic vacation with Keiko, because whom amongst us has not been frantically trying to give everybody instructions before you take off on vacation, knowing that all of it is meaningless and they'll just text you anyway?
My notes in this moment in this episode, my only interjection, I promise, no, I can't promise that, are, oh God, I'm O'Brien, O'Brien is me. Is this what I look like when I'm leaving on vacation?
Also, I feel like O'Brien would enjoy people texting him on vacation.
Fair. So on his dash across the promenade to join his wife in the minivan, he runs across a former crewmate of his named Raymond Boone. They chat briefly and agree to have drinks once Miles is back from vacation. And afterward, we learn that, ruh-roh, Boone recorded their conversation.
Dun, dun, dun.
So on the runabout, Miles and Keiko start to bicker, but quickly realize that there are much better things that they could be doing in a runabout on cruise control, such as fucking. Before they finish brainstorming what they could do with the non-reclining chairs, however, they are rudely interrupted by the arrival of a Cardassian ship captained by Gull Avec. At torpedo point, they let Avec board for a inspection, and he promptly arrests O'Brien, refusing to give any information regarding the charges. Miles is whisked away to Cardassia Prime for processing and his eventual trial. The prison officials strip, restrain, scan, and sedate him, and remove one of his molars with a pair of pliers in a deeply uncomfortable moment that we all hate. O'Brien continues stating his name and Federation citizenship, and a Cardassian woman enters the room. She apologizes for the harsh treatment and introduces herself as Chief Archon Machbar. O'Brien's trial is scheduled in 2 days, and he has been assigned the best legal counsel in all of Cardassia, the venerable Conservator Kovat. However, she still refuses to tell him what he's being charged with, and he maintains his innocence. Back on the station, Keiko, Sisko, and Odo are strategizing. Keiko recounts Miles' tales of Starfleet officers captured by Cardassians and returning changed. And Odo helpfully confirms that, yes, the Cardassians do routinely torture their prisoners.
You're not helping, Odo.
No, I actually disagree. I disagree. She's freaking out, and Sisko is like, is kind of blowing some smoke at her, and she doesn't need that in that moment. She needs someone to tell her the truth and to not dismiss her fear. And Odo is like, no, you're right. They're probably torturing him, but let's move on. I think she is not comforted, but like she kind of starts getting it together once Odo is like,
He's not blowing her off.
Yeah,
he's not blowing off her concerns.
We can plan for this.
It's a weird moment where he's like,
we can rehabilitate him once he's back home.
I think it's a situation where Odo, where Sisko, not super experienced in hostage negotiation and dealing with a wife that has a husband that's been captured by Cardassians. Whereas Odo's like, yes, this was a Tuesday for me back when this was Tarak Nor. I've done this before. Yeah. I know how to have this conversation.
So Machbar contacts the station, but also refuses to explain to them the charges or allow them to speak to O'Brien, and informs them that he is scheduled for execution in a week. Because in Cardassian law, the verdict is reached before the trial, and the trial itself just explains how the verdict was reached. Keiko may attend as the spouse, as may Odo in the role of Nestor, or advisor to the defendant. They leave for Cardassia Prime, leaving Kira to try to figure out what the fuck is going on. Kira and Jadzia quickly realize that 24 warheads have been stolen, and voice print logs show that O'Brien was in the weapons locker immediately before the beam out. As the Maquis stole torpedo launchers very recently, there's no question as to where those warheads are headed. Notably, they do not figure out how the Cardassians could have obtained any of this information, or who in the Maquis would have received the weapons, though. Miles is first joined in his cell by Conservator Kovat, whose role in the trial is not what we consider to be a defense lawyer. It is instead to get Miles to confess his guilt and concede to the wisdom of the Cardassian state. After arriving, Odo also checks on O'Brien, explaining that the traumatic dental work was because the Cardassians keep a molar on file for everyone in the population. Odo questions Miles about Kira and Dax's findings, but he convincingly denies ever dealing with the Maquis and certainly ever giving them weapons. Back on the station, Dax discovers that the voice print was forged, and Kira identifies Boone as likely involved. Boone denies involvement, and Bashir is visited by a mysterious Maquis member who claims that he is not one of us. Sisko questions why Boone left Starfleet, divorced his wife, and no longer speaks to his parents, and when Boone's answers don't line up with, you know, the truth, he is restrained for medical scans. The trial commences, broadcast to all of Cardassia, on live TV, and with Makbar flanked by an honest-to-God panel of Cardassian children. Miles declines to confess, and Keiko declines to testify against him. When Odo tries to share the findings from the investigation, Kovat reminds him that no new evidence can be entered at this point. He should have done that before the trial. Odo further questions the venue for this trial, as the crime was a theft of Starfleet weapons on a Bajoran station. But the trial proceeds, with evidence coming from unnameable, reliable sources, accusations that Miles is prejudiced against Cardassians. Let's be fair, they're not entirely wrong. And last-ditch question.
We do catch a record of O'Brien throwing a slur around.
Yeah, he's definitely said, you know, the damn Cardies before on numerous occasions. So they're not really wrong on that one. But there's also some last-ditch questioning from Kovat attempting to pin Miles's motivations on abuse by his parents and or by Keiko. Kovat then decides to concede the case on O'Brien's behalf, at which point Sisko arrives with Boone in tow. Makbar sees them and immediately changes her tune, congratulating herself on bringing a guilty man to justice, but claiming that Miles can be rehabilitated and that she will release him back into Federation custody. Back on the station, Sisko explains that Boone was actually a Cardassian all along. The real Boone died in captivity and was replaced, and the missing molar gave him away.
Bad the medical skins.
Right, that too. But you know, the molar, this episode really hinges on the molar. Just be real.
That DNA proving that he's of a different species, that's something. But the molar?
Yeah, the molar. Miles was just a convenient, mildly Cardassian-hating scapegoat in a ploy to implicate the Federation in arming the Maquis. And Makbar ended the trial rather than risk Sisko exposing the whole plot on live television. Miles says he's looking forward to returning to work, but Sisko insists, no, he and Keiko are actually going to take their vacation. O'Brien is dismayed.
You don't think that O'Brien hates vacations because something awful always happens to him when he tries to
take one?
He served on the Enterprise.
He knows how this shit goes. Like, yeah. Listen, yeah. Jordy went on a vacation and got turned into a Romulan sleeper agent.
Yeah. Who do you think had to deprogram all of those people from those ARPG headsets? I just imagine O'Brien sitting there with like an eye scanner.
He's like,
all right, you're clear.
I've
Next.
Survived being a named character of the Enterprise. I know what happens when I go on vacation.
Yeah. Okay. I want to do this at the top. For all the money in my bank account, I would have believed that the guy who played Boone was on B5. I was so sure.
He has a random B5 guest actor look. If you ask me to expect him,
he looks like Gary Cole. If yes. y'all know who that is.
Yeah, I can see it.
I was so sure that he had played like Psycop 4 or like Random Bar Patron 2.
Or like Scumbag Traitor 5.
Yeah, just so
It's certain. The mustache, I think. The mustache and the hair. It's like ridiculously 90s.
Yeah, because he okay, no. I know what it is. He looks like he's got to be a security officer on B5. He looks like he's one of Garibaldi's peons.
He's something. Just really, I was like so sure, but nope.
No, yeah.
This fucking episode. Another episode I hate on like two different axes. On the one hand, I hate everything about Cardassian justice and the absolutely like intentionally fucking pointlessness of it.
Yeah, the
and also
I don't think it'll fucking surprise you to know that this was inspired heavily by Franz Kafka's The Trial.
Yeah, that I read your note on that and I was like, okay, checks out.
I thought it was just based on the Japanese criminal justice system.
Mental note, I want to come back to that. Why the molar? Why take it out? Why yank it out with pliers? I'm putting that on my fucking list of things that when I start a new game and we do our session zero, that's going on my list.
Yeah.
That's on my line list now.
It helps
violence against children and yanking molars out with pliers.
I realize that this did not help you, but I at this point know exactly the timing for that scene in this episode and like know exactly when to cover my eyes for 10 seconds.
It's so unnecessary. They have fucking spaceships that go faster than light. Get a fucking use a laser.
Like they weren't. That wasn't for the enjoyment of the Cardassian processors. Oh,
I know. I'm just saying. Okay. So to rewind slightly, I give O'Brien credit. He's blowing this vacation thing, but then he realizes it, and he knows how to apologize to his wife.
Yeah.
Comma. His musical choice feels racist. Is it racist? It feels racist.
Well, actually, this is one of those things where, like, I always have complicated feelings on the O'Briens, and I feel like at this point, I land on, like, I like their relationship, and it's not their fault that it was written in the 90s. I always view that as, like, you know, he's connecting with her culture and like putting on music that she'll like putting on a favorite or something.
Yeah.
I think it's
90s racist.
Yeah, no, just the whenever you hear a Shabbos set, it's like it's your L5R sense start tingling.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. That is exactly it's L5R racist is what it is.
He's playing nice music for his wife.
Yeah, it
and
is.
Like, I would like.
It's.
I would like.
What
to,
I
like,
really want is I want that scene redubbed, and instead of it being a shamisen, I want it to be like Irish jig, and see if the scene feels the same.
Well, the problem is that they couldn't afford to license Barry White, so.
Yeah, there you go. Put on some "Let's Get It On," and that scene feels much better.
Seriously,
I will say though. Of the two scenes, last episode's Kira and Baryl and O'Brien and Keiko, the latter is much sexier.
Yeah.
O'Brien can get it in this scene.
Cole Meany is a sexy man and he knows how to game.
Yeah, and it's such a like tender little scene where like, you know, he's like putting his head in her lap and it's like it's very like cute and like it's like cute and sexy in a very like genuine way.
Yeah. And I like that she's like, do these seats go down? You're an engineer, you can figure it out.
Why don't the seats recline in the runabout?
Question.
I know. Like, well, also,
why can't they just replicate themselves at, like, an air mattress?
Or, well, if there, okay, so here's my question. Like you think, like, they use them as transports. They travel for days. Like, there's gotta be a bunk.
There are. There are sleeping quarters in the back of that thing.
Yeah, the thing is basically like...
Okay, no. All right, that's fair. That's fair.
But here's my one thing about that. Okay. The control panel's like a desk. What do you need a reclining... Get creative, my friends.
And... Well, except
and it is, okay, it so is established canon that you can disable the touch controls.
See? Yes.
Yes.
But I do think that there's a 50% chance of Majel Barrett chiming in if you do so.
Have you seen the episode with Odo and Lakshmana Troy? That's not a bad thing.
I've seen many episodes with Lakshmana Troy.
What was that? There was something else, but I'm just O'Brien's dad fit. Let's talk about O'Brien's daddest dad fit.
So he has like, it's a blue button down and everything except the buttons. It's like the double breasted shirt that they have in the 24th century with like no fasteners. He is wearing gray.
It's the space version of gray pleated khakis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he is wearing a belt that is not looped through any belt holes. Or like belt loops. Like it is just slung on his hips like a gunslinger.
It works though.
Our description, if you haven't seen this episode, we'll try and remember. I don't know if it'll happen. It's you know how this podcast works. We'll try and remember to put a picture of it up on the internet though.
Go to your favorite Google pirating for fuck's site. Sake. Play the first 90 seconds of this episode and enjoy this look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is look. Short of him wearing cargo shorts, he could not look more like a dad than in this outfit. Yeah. It has such...
I would make one small adjustment, which is that put it one non-button button higher.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's got a little bit of chest showing.
He's going on vacation. One button unbuttoned is dad's way of saying he's on vacation.
And like, you know, we have standards showing that, like, you know, when Starfleet in this time period buttons down a shirt, like they button down a shirt. We have Picard on Risa with the like the deep V that goes like halfway down to his belly button. So we have, you know, this is pretty buttoned down compared to that.
I want you to think about the fact that the Picard on Risa outfit exists and was worn by O'Brien's captain.
Yeah. Because Captain Picard's just a little bit of a slut.
All right.
Now TNG, I can speak more quickly on. Everyone wants Picard to fuck on Risa. The entire crew is saying, Picard, you need to go fuck. Riker is saying, here's this secret fuck statue I'm going to give you and not tell you what it is. Make sure you hang on to this fuck statue so you can fuck.
And Picard's just like, I am here to read my book.
Look, goblin. Motherfucker, nobody goes to Risa wearing that outfit to read a book unless that book is the Space Kama Sutra. That's my two cents.
I mean,
also, I would like to say that I would absolutely go for, I would absolutely kill for Cole Meany in that outfit. Like,
oh my gosh.
Please give me that image. Oh my God. Please.
I just want to imagine Picard going to the transporter pad in that outfit and like the door opening and O'Brien like just stiff as a board, just like, Captain. Awkward silence as Picard, you know, in his flip flops up to the transporter pad
and in his hot pants that show off everything.
All right, but I propose to you a different scenario wherein Picard had an undershirt on under that, and when O'Brien beamed him down to Risa, he did not beam him.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, that's even better. Yeah. O'Brien just suddenly getting in on the fun. Oh, man. Okay. Do we have anything else to say about this episode?
I mean, yeah, I think there's a lot about like the actual like content of it beyond.
Yes.
I find
Cole Meany fucks. Yeah.
I think of this like there's a really, in this we learn that Cardassian jurisprudence, like we talked a little bit about this in The Wire, like how art in a way is in service to the Cardassian state. Criminal justice here is there. There isn't anything that is like there actually has been no crime done to Cardassia. It is all a show to show a Federation criminal being subject to Cardassian law and to make the Federation look bad when there actually hasn't been any crime committed against Cardassians or any crime committed in the Cardassian territories.
Yeah.
Which I find, it is terrifying. Like Kovat says, whatever you've done, whatever the charges against you, none of that really matters in the long run. This trial is to demonstrate the futility of behavior contrary to good order.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do want to say Kovat puts on a fucking show.
Man.
Like we're talking the Cardassian Better Call Saul type. Absolutely.
He has some gem lines.
I guess he's good at his job as a Cardassian defense counselor.
Yeah.
Terrible as his job as a defense attorney. But, you know, he's like,
he knows how to go on TV.
I'm doing the best that I can. I'm trying to get him to confess and this, it's not me.
He has some great lines. The like, winning isn't everything. And the, but think of the children.
Fritz Weaver.
Did your parents abuse you as a child?
Unduly. Did your parents unduly abuse you? Or the, don't ruin this. I'm a year away from retirement.
The fucking, his last minute.
That line was so good. I died.
And the thing is, like, he's absolutely going to get railroaded as an enemy into the state in like 2 weeks and executed in 3, right?
Yeah, no, this, he's done after this.
But he's just going, what just happened? And he goes, you won. He goes, oh, they'll kill me.
I love this episode so much.
One thing that I do love is like Avery Brooks. I like, he's got good folks to work with here, but he absolutely, like, this episode is fantastic. And apparently, Avery Brooks at first was not easy to work with as a director. Cause he would just like, he's the assistant director, was like, yeah, no, he was pretty closed. The direct quote from assistant director BC Cameron, he called me aside in Quark's bar. I was pitch black in there because we weren't shooting in there. It was dark and I went in and he said, I want you to make sure I get what I need. And I said, it's kind of difficult sometimes because I come to ask you questions and you act like you don't want to tell me things or that I'm bothering you. And he said, I guess you don't understand my sense of humor. And I said, to be honest with you, sir, I'm not sure you have one. And he kind of reared back his shoulders, turned around, a little half grin came on his face. He said, well, what is it you want to know? and he's like, and she was like,
wait. I need you to take a step back because from the way you just described that, that means that how that actual conversation was happening was that Avery Brooks had his back turned to his subordinate and had her walk into a dark room and said, I need you to get me what I need.
God, what a fucking... My God.
Incredible.
So he's just forgotten how not to be Cisco is what I'm hearing.
And apparently, like, once they got through that, like, it would be that, like, Brooks would just like, okay, I'm going to walk you through like everything that I want through the scene. This is how we're going to line up shots and do it. And like, he apparently got like really intense into it. And then it's like, okay, once we've broached past this initial thing, we were getting on fine.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Interesting. There's one thing I want to ping back to with like, so we discussed a few episodes ago with, you know, in the Maquis, whether O'Brien would join the Maquis or like what, you know, to what degree O'Brien would be tempted to join the Maquis. I feel like this is a fantastic, like, I kept thinking about this episode as you were, you know, as you were talking about that, Jude. I feel like this is the, like, you know, the absolute, like, ultimate rebuttal of, like, would O'Brien join the Maquis?
If he wasn't gonna before, he might now.
I think that it is. I think it's the whole thing of O'Brien is too lawful to do it.
Yeah.
Well, no,
yeah.
He's not actually going to join the Maquis. But as I noted in my notes, this is not going to do anything to improve O'Brien's positive attitudes about Cardassians.
But also he does very, very strongly believe in the Federation.
Yeah, no, he's not going to join the Maquis, at least not really, I don't think.
Yeah.
I could see him, like, being the perfect person to send undercover in the Maquis.
Yeah.
Because certainly nobody would be surprised, I think, if he claimed to be joining the Maquis. I think only his best friends would really know him well enough to know he'd never actually do it. But anybody looking from the outside would be like, yeah, that checks out. Yeah, I feel like I hope there is an episode someday that does some kind of examination of the fact that I'm sure O'Brien fucking hates Cardassians now. If he didn't before, I'm sure he fucking hates them now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I hope there is some kind that that's addressed in some degree, because good Lord, he must hate them an awful lot now. Not that he didn't before, but it's a very different thing to have someone yank you off your ship in front of your wife, you know, strip you naked, photograph you, yank out one of your teeth, and then use you as a pretext to try and start a war with the Federation.
Don't worry, this isn't even going to be the worst encounter that, that O'Brien has with the criminal justice system of a foreign power.
But he already hates the Cardassians, is I think my point.
I think, yeah. I think you will. I think the interesting part is going to be that things will change, like, that is that he might hate Cardassia's estate, but I think there's going to be some, there are some fun stuff coming up where
the difference between Cardassians and the Cardassian state will be exemplified. Yes.
Including one of my favorite funny O'Brien Garrick moments.
All right.
I'm surprised we didn't get Garrick in this episode.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I was the second point I was going to make about this episode is that what kind of absolute fucking anarchy exists in this sector that Bashir, of all people, has become some kind of regular pipeline for underground intel on DS9. The Cardassians are passing intel through him. Now the goddamn Maquis is passing intel through him.
Yeah.
Who? How did this happen? That this hapless twink has become a critical juncture in the intel distribution network between these three powers, between the Bajorans, the Cardassians, and the Federation. That's insane.
I mean, insane is the correct
madness.
Way to describe it.
Yeah.
But yes, it does seem like Garrick would have been a it would have made sense for Garrick to be in this episode, but also I do like
there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on. And I like that it was just like, you know, I can sort of imagine Bashir like groping his jaw and feeling that that missing molar there and putting two and two together.
Also, is nobody concerned that the Cardassians now have like a full holo scan and retinal scan and tooth from O'Brien? Like, is nobody concerned about this?
Okay. So here's the thing. I want to point out two things. One is that this is the most insane plastic surgery in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Except
the
Cardassians
Buddha's
doing the regular, apparently.
Yeah, Buddha's a Seska.
Yeah, and, you know, somehow they shaved down those massive Cardassian shoulders to, like, the skinniest, like, little Han Solo-like that you've seen. But also, hi, listeners. Last time I was on this show, we had full replicant technology that lets you replace a person and make it fully indistinguishable. But
I don't think the Cardassians have that tech. They don't have the facilities.
Oh, okay, that was. Did we? Okay, that I kind of assumed that that was implied to be
Cardassian. Oh no, it was a Gamma Quadrant but, species.
Yeah,
fair enough. All right, so
it's interesting that they like reuse this plot in Discovery with the Klingons.
I mean,
it's an old thing that they have done so
Star Trek
so many
has done
times.
It a lot of
okay.
times.
Because like, Back to the Future. Be disguised as an alien species at one point.
Oh, I thought we were going with like, you know, members of the crew on trial, and I'm like, that's how Star Trek started, baby.
No, I mean like having the having a humanoid but not human looking species. Modified down to fit in to look like a human.
I mean, like Seska. Seska exists. Like we had like how many seasons with her as like a major like.
She's only side character for, like, two seasons.
It feels like so much more. But like yeah, Seska's like a whole thing.
Yeah.
In Voyager, but yeah, the
I didn't watch a lot of Voyager, so
and then there's the episode where Riker gets disguised as an alien and then ends up in the hospital and encounters the alien fucker too.
Oh yeah,
yep, yep. And then there's the Klingon that doesn't realize he's a Klingon.
Yeah, I mean, but like you know, it was a well trodden path before Disco picked it up.
Yeah, no, I just mean it's interesting that they. Yeah,
yeah,
a well-traveled trope, so to speak.
Yeah, I also consistently wonder, like how many exactly of all of those like captured Starfleet officers who came back changed are just fucking Cardassians, like all of them, right?
Yeah.
Well, you got to believe that all of them. Are gonna get got yanked out of their current assignments that the second Sisko got back to Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Hey, how many teeth do you have?
Yeah, just
random
quick,
question.
Quick dental record check.
Yeah.
But
don't Starfleet officers get randomly? Oh, because he quit Starfleet like right away.
Yeah, quit Starfleet. Mm-hmm.
So they probably all quit Starfleet.
Kind of makes you what like. This is kind of like the weirdest long game for the Cardassians, because it's like, we're going to replace a Starfleet member. You're going to then immediately leave Starfleet, become a civilian. No, you're going to have nothing. No political sway.
Yeah, I mean, he ends up on a Federation colony that, or like a human colony in Cardassian space, so it's like, oh, hey, I've got a... Like we've got sleeper agents there who look like humans, I guess.
It's kind of like a spy novel plot in a lot of ways, like with an undercover agent.
Yeah,
and
yeah. This is just a double. Like this is your standard like sleeper agent plot.
Sorry, not again to just relate everything back to the first O'Brien episode I was on, but in a world where we have cameras that can tell the molecular makeup of anything, we didn't. Put one of those in the weapons storage.
Yeah.
No right. cameras.
Yeah.
Voice print. The technology that can be beat with a pocket tape recorder.
Yep.
Computer, beam all weapons to Jude's house.
Also, can I ask why did they go with a technology that requires you to say your password out loud?
Because
I don't know, considering that this is like Speaking of Trek tropes that have recurred many times, the flaws of having a voice password for everything is one of them.
Yeah.
And they're always dumb passwords, too. They're never, like, interesting passwords. It's always, like, Riker 72 Alpha. It's like...
Except for the command codes for the ship where, like, they rattle off, like, a 75 digit alphanumeric string, and you're like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. This is one of those things where Star Trek is not science fiction, it's space fantasy, and you should just not think about it too much.
Yeah. As we all understand the two core tenets of Star Trek. One, Star Trek is fucking awesome. Two, Star Trek is fucking stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm learning to embrace the second one.
One of my favorite things of this episode is that I love the design of the court because it is ridiculous. It is
yeah.
everything about fascist architecture rolled up into one redressed hollow suite set.
Yes.
But my favorite part of it is the office chairs.
Yeah.
Because those high shot looking down at them like, I recognize those chairs. I worked in those chairs.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. My favorite part of that is that in this little panel of jury, quote unquote, members of children, and the court starts and they all just start doing little tappy taps on how excited they are about court about to happen.
Those are some bloodthirsty children.
Yes.
Little taps.
I'm not saying my son would send someone to die for a crime they dubiously committed, but I'm saying knowing some 7-year-olds with the right conditioning wouldn't be a problem.
I also love that they have a panel of actual facts children there so that Kovac can then be like, think of the children and point to the actual panel of children. I love it. What a good gag.
Cardassian justice is fucking insane. And I say this as someone with borderline zero faith in our existing justice system. I'm not saying we're doing a lot better, but at least there's the illusion of justice in ours. Theirs is just a straight up railroad.
Speaking of which, I think, Evan, you wanted to talk about the Japanese criminal justice system, right?
Sure. I mean, I'm not claim to be a expert or anything, given that my main experience with it is two different video game series.
Okay, fair.
Those video game series, for anyone wondering, being Phoenix Wright and Judgment, both of which are extremely good games, but the bare essentials of which you can get, which is just looking at the statistics of Japanese criminal court, which is that there's about a 98% conviction rate, which very, very much makes you go, are they really that good at finding criminals, or is it that bad about innocent people?
Yeah.
Which one it is, listener. So when you get to Cardassia going like, listen, you're guilty. It's a foregone conclusion. The court never gets it wrong.
I wanted Cisco to just flay that guy open and spill his Cardassian blood all over Cardassian live TV so bad. And instead, Cisco just smirks at her like, nah, gotcha, bitch.
Yeah.
I love how he's not dramatic the way that like Kirk is dramatic. Because Kirk has that flair for like the big moment. You know what I mean? Whereas Cisco likes to win. And then he likes to smile at you and look smug. And I got to tell you, I like Cisco's version better.
Cisco likes to have the leverage. Cisco belongs on leverage is what it is, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, he lives for like the end of the leverage episode where the crew all like looks at the person who they just like the evil dude who they just screwed and like smirks and waves high.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was slightly wrong in that I was under. Japan has a 99.8% conviction rate. God.
Fuck me sideways.
2021.
Wow. Wow.
That's statistically improbable, yeah. As I think how I want to put that.
Yeah.
All right.
Evan, do you want people to find you on the internet?
Sure, why not? I'm not doing too much at the moment because my brain is largely broken in case my wild tangents in this don't make evidence of that.
No, that just makes you the standard bad podcast.
Yeah.
Ah, come on. I mean, you can find me on most social medias at Names Equipped. You can find the podcast that I do, quote unquote, at Rollout Podcast. It's an actual play with a whole bunch of shit, but also like a whole bunch of systems. There's a main running mass system. I do designer interviews once in a blue moon because I'm ADD as hell and I couldn't decide to have multiple podcasts like these fine folks. If you like tabletop games, you can find mine at itch.io/saftware, SAFTWARE.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us, Evan. As for us, next week, we will be doing our season 2 finale. So join us for season 2, episode 26, The Jem'Hadar.
Ooh.
Until next time, just keep circling. Keep circling. Just keep circling.
Just keep circling.
Oh, you're fine. You're fine.
I went. Okay.
Anything that makes Aaron's life more difficult.
You clapped at objectively the correct time, Evan.
I clapped when Justin was going to say clap.
Yeah, but see, that's not what we do.
I didn't realize it was 1, 2, 3 clap mm-hmm. hands.
Yeah, we make it difficult for guests so that it can be wrong and we can make it harder for Aaron.
I don't know how people are supposed to do these things. I truly don't. This is just...
I think you're supposed to go 1, 2, 3 and then on the 4 beat, everybody claps rather than 1, 2, 3 clap and then on the 5 beat, everybody claps, which is legitimately the most insane way to do it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you could also do, like, you know, my old staple of time.is and just tell everyone what number to clap on.
Yeah, we tried that.
We used to do that.
We could not manage that one. That was even worse than the clapping.
May I ask what the issue was?
Basic literacy.
Yeah, okay. It was a lot.
Fair enough.
You know, you tell people a time and then there's questions of like, well, wait, do we clap on a time or do we say time on the time? And then somebody always thinks it's the wrong time. And then somebody talks during the silence and then you have to start over. And we just don't care that much. Aaron, I got to tell you,
Aaron, just put this conversation between just keep circling and your actual outro for this one. just put the middle, like in between that, this.
Yes, please do. That'd be great.
Okay.
Just keep circling.
The Babylon Project is an independent production. All views expressed on the show are our own. Clips from the original show remain property of the original owner. Music information can be found in the show notes. The rest of the show is licensed under a Creative Commons 4.0 share-alike no derivatives license.